Hello, I'm Rithula Shah. Thank you for downloading the World Tonight podcast on Tuesday, the 7th of February. On the programme, as President Assad tells reporters his family doesn't own Syria, we hear about testimony which suggests that thousands of people may have been executed in Syrian prisons. And we debate whether the need to reach a peace deal will triumph over those who want to see Syrian leaders tried for war crimes. Also, we'll hear the latest from the Brexit debate in the Commons, and we report from Diane Abbott's constituency on Labour's dilemma over Brexit. And how do you fancy working just 6 hours a day? The Swedes have tried it. We find out if they liked it. President Assad now appears to be on the verge of crushing the Syrian uprising that became a civil war. Backed by Russia and Iran, Mr. Assad has every reason to be confident of holding on to power. But speaking to a reporter from the Belgian channel VRT-TV in Damascus tonight, Bashar al-Assad said his family didn't own the country they've run for 46 years.
If the Syrian people choose another president, I don't have to choose to be aside. I would be aside. We don't own the country. My family doesn't own the country to say that only Assad should be in that position. That's self-evident.
President Assad's comments come on the day that the campaign group Amnesty International has claimed that thousands of people, most of them civilian opposition supporters, have been secretly executed at a Syrian prison. Amnesty says it's spoken to more than 80 people, including former detainees and guards at Sardinia prison near Damascus. On the basis of their testimony, the human rights organisation estimates that between 5,000 and 13,000 people are executed there over a five-year period between September 2011 and December 2015. Nicolette Waldman, the report's author, said there was little in the way of justice for those who were killed.
What we found was that not only was there no due process, there wasn't even any semblance of a trial. Before they are hanged, detainees face a 1 or 2 minute procedure where they are condemned to death. And what a military judge told me was that these trials had no relationship with any form of judicial process. And in fact, they weren't even trials.
The testimony that's emerged from the report is harrowing, with torture and the knowledge that fellow prisoners were being killed part of daily existence. Tonight, the Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, has said he's sickened by the report's findings. Jalal Mundo is a former detainee who spent some time in Sardinia. He described what life was like when he was first put in prison.
First of all, maybe 10 or 12 or 13 of soldiers, they start to beat me everywhere. I try to shout or try to talk, then they make it more and more without reason. Next, they make us naked. We don't have any clothes. I didn't talk about one prison because I moved from Homs to Damascus to Sardinia to like so much prison, not only one. Because when you talk about military prison, it's not only the problem about Sardinia. It's so much prison in Syria.
So other prisons are like Sardinia?
So much. It's not only one or two. Like nobody know how many.
So you arrive, they take all your clothes away. And then how many people are in your prison cell?
I can't tell you exactly the number, but its first one, it was around 200 people. It was so small for 200 people, 5 meter in 5 meter. And we can't go to toilet just one time for 10 seconds. You have 10 seconds to drink water from the toilet, to go out, and you have just only 2 times eat, and it's not allowed to talk. If you talk, you will die. This is the rule you learn in first day. No sun, no talking, no nothing. Like, you let everything out of the prison. You let your humanity outside. You start to be somehow animal.
Were you tortured?
Yeah. I mean, for me, they hang me from my hand. Then I can't touch the floor for 19 days. When they hug us every day, they kill 5 people. And you don't know who the next, you or not. In this 19 days, I couldn't sleep. I lost my mind. I start to be a little bit crazy. After this 19 days, my hand, I couldn't move it. And also, I was 80 kilo. In this 19 days, I was around 45, 50 kilo.
So you lost almost half your body weight?
Yeah.
At the end of 19 days, what happened to you?
They take my signature. And they told me, we will send you to the judge. They put me in the small room, this small room, just to collect people who died.
Did you think you were going to die?
I, of course. So horrible situation, so much illness. And every day we have 5 people die. And in the evening, they give us, when we come in, number, because you must forget your name. Then it was my number 99. I couldn't forget this number. Every day they open the door in the evening and they call 10 number, 5 number, 6 number, nobody know. And you don't know it's your number or no. All of these people, they go in the evening, they bring them to Sednaya or to directly to kill, to hanging. In the morning, they bring people in the morning in civil prison. It will be the good situation there. And you every day, you hope you will have your number in the morning, not in the evening.
Do you have any sense of why you were spared?
In the general, I don't know. I tried so much to keep myself strong, to say I could stay alive. I can go back to my family. I can go to get my dream, to be good director and to make film. But why they didn't kill me, I don't know exactly why.
And Jalal, the suggestion is then that thousands of people were hanged in Sednaya. Do you believe that? Do you think that could have happened?
I just can't believe in one thing, the number. I believe it's more than this. I couldn't believe it's just only 13,000.
Jalal Mando there. Well, the British government was one of a number of countries which had consistently argued that President Assad must go as part of any Syrian peace deal. However, in recent weeks, the success of Syrian government forces backed by Russia and Iran in defeating the rebels and the threat from so-called Islamic State had forced some to rethink the policy. Last month, the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson told the Lords there was a need to be realistic about the way the landscape has changed, adding that it was conceivable that Assad could stand in a future election. So what impact should these latest allegations of mass torture and execution have on the future for President Assad in any kind of Syrian peace deal? Andrew Mitchell is a Conservative MP and a former International Development Secretary, and David Crane is the founding chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone, who indicted the former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor. And he's also the founding member of the Syrian Accountability Project, which has compiled a 20-page indictment against President Assad. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
David Crane, in your view, should President Assad be tried for war crimes at the International Criminal Court?
Well, President Assad should be held accountable for what he has done to the Syrian people someday when there is a geopolitical climate to do so. I think it's too early to specifically state which court it should be in, whether it be, should be the International Criminal Court or a domestic court, a regional court that may be set up among Arab states or an international tribunal. So at this point in time, he will not be held accountable, but I can assure you that someday he will be held accountable. It's just not the right political climate to do so.
Andrew Mitchell, the accusations that have been made today are fairly harrowing in their detail. Can there be peace in Syria with President Assad in charge or still in the political firmament?
Well, I think I agree very much with David Crane's analysis. I think that President Assad is part of the problem, and therefore dealing with him is bound to be part of the solution. These are harrowing, bestial events that have been catalogued by Amnesty International, who deserve great praise, actually, for what they have brought into the public domain. And there are a number of things that have to happen now. In my view, the United Nations must insist and seek to get Russian support for this, that there is unfettered access to these prisons so that we can at least have an eye on stopping what is happening from here on. And as far as Assad is concerned, many of us have said that the West saying he's got to go and they have no power to implement all of this simply isn't helping. So my view is that the critical thing we have to do is to try and get a peace settlement and a negotiation which starts from the bottom up, including as many of the parties in Syria as possible. And then it may be in the future, as David said, that international justice can take its course. I very much hope that will be the case.
So in a sense, you're conceding the fact that if there is to be some sort of peace deal in Syria, President Assad has to be a partner in it, simply because he clearly does have support in a significant section of the country.
We have to recognise the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. The critical thing is to stop the killing in Syria and to try and get a bottom-up peace process. It may well be that in the future, President Assad and other members of his regime who have carried out these appalling atrocities can be held to account, but these things are sequential. We must first of all make sure that the killing stops and that there's a credible peace process.
David Crane, if you accept the idea that this has to be sequential, then don't you as a lawyer fear that justice will fall victim to realpolitik?
No, in fact, I am a big believer in realpolitik because it's important to get the job done. We did that in West Africa when I took down a head of state. You have to deal with the world as it is. And, you know, this is the classic peace versus justice situation. Do we have peace first, then justice, or do we have justice, then peace? And my colleague is absolutely correct. At this point in time, the geopolitical situation doesn't warrant some type of accountability. That's fine. We'll go ahead and see if we can have some type of peace, however it's brokered. And then over time, we can continue to work the issues. I can give you a perfect vignette. President Charles Taylor, just 11 years ago, never thought he'd be held accountable for the murder, rape, maiming, and mutilation of over 1.2 million human beings. Now he sits in Her Majesty's maximum security prison in the northeast of England for the rest of his life. So international justice may seem to be very slow, but again, your listeners must understand there is no statute of limitations for these crimes. So he's always liable. And I really want to underscore, and I think it's important, a very significant event took place last Friday where the Secretary General implemented a resolution that was passed by 105 nations in the General Assembly on the 21st of December, where they created the UN's first official permanent office called the Independent Mechanism for Prosecution of War Crimes in Syria, where all of the world's best and brightest will come together and build that case officially against all the warring parties. So this may take 5 years, it may take 10 years, but I can assure your listeners, people will be held accountable for this.
David Crane, Andrew Mitchell, thank you both very much. It could be described as a deal or no deal option. The government successfully headed off a possible Conservative rebellion by agreeing to give both houses of Parliament a vote on the final Brexit deal before it's put to the European Parliament. Labour said the government's decision was an important concession, but the pledge comes with significant caveats. Our political correspondent Tom Bateman's on the line from Westminster. Tom, what exactly is being promised here?
Well, I think the very first point here is this is a significant victory for the government tonight, because what they have done is offered what was being described as a concession to effectively buy off any potential or dangerous rebellion that they might have Conservative MPs going in their numbers with Labour and backing a Labour amendment on this Article 50 bill. So the first point is that the government have seen that off, and they have done that by offering a verbal guarantee at the dispatch box in the House of Commons, which we are told was agreed beforehand. The very wording of it was agreed with some of those MPs who were concerned about this. And what the concession does is to say that MPs will get a vote on any future deal. They will get it before the European Parliament gets to vote. And also they've sort of widened slightly the language here in saying that it will also be a vote on the future relationship with the European Union. Now, that was important because some MPs had felt that if there was no deal, they didn't want a sort of cliff edge. So the government seems to have addressed that to some extent. However, the big caveat here is clearly not enough for some. MPs like Heidi Allen and Anna Soubry voted with Labour on this. And there were certainly signs that some MPs were pretty unhappy. Nicky Morgan, one of those other potential rebels, seen having heated exchanges in the chamber of the House of Commons during the vote with the Chief Whip, Gavin Williamson. And another sign of just how seriously the government was taking this, Theresa May herself was in the division lobby trying to reassure those wavering MPs as the vote was taking place.
But just to be clear then, if they were to vote no, what they've been told is there will be no coming back. There'll be no going to renegotiate before it comes back to them.
Well, this is it. And this is what the Brexit minister set out when he was pressed by MPs during the debate on this. And I think this is what has caused some concern among those potentially rebellious Conservative MPs, in that when he was pushed, he said quite explicitly, no, this will be a take it or leave it vote. Either you accept the deal the government has, or there will be no deal. And in effect, we come out and we rely on World Trade Organization rules with all the tariffs that that involves. So a concession to some, but a concession clearly that does not go far enough for many of those with concerns.
Very briefly then, Tom, tomorrow MPs will vote on the committee stage of the bill to trigger Article 50. Talk of the Labour leadership imposing a three-line whip on the vote. Are there likely to be some rebels?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's been made clear today that Labour, Jeremy Corbyn, will impose that three-line whip. So I expect we will get rebels. Remember, 47 Labour MPs, including many in the front bench, did not vote in favour of the Article 50 bill last week. So I expect that will continue tomorrow. And then we have to look at those like Clive Lewis, who's suggested he may resign if there weren't conditions attached to the bill, which there haven't been. And others, of course, like Diane Abbott.
Tom Bateman, thank you very much. Well, Diane Abbott, the Shadow Home Secretary, will be one of those under close scrutiny when it comes to the Labour Rebel Watch tomorrow. She's a close ally of the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and would normally be a loyal member of his frontbench team. But Ms Abbott represents one of the most pro-Remain constituencies in the country. Nearly 80% of voters in Hackney North and Stoke Newington wanted to stay in the European Union. So eyebrows were raised last week when Diane Abbott failed to turn up for the first stage vote on Article 50, saying that she'd suffered a migraine. One critic called it Brexit flu. And as Paul Moss reports, the vote on whether to trigger Article 50 is now causing a schism among Labour supporters in her constituency, one that could well have echoes across the country.
They advertise artisan cakes at the Sapit Cafe. Some of these, like the lemon polenta sponge, are gluten-free. Yes, we're in Stoke Newington, the heartland of Diane Abbott's constituency, and an area often mocked for its middle-class liberal sensibilities. I was joined at the cafe by Ruth and Vishal. They're both lifelong Labour voters, but they're both very, very angry at the behaviour of their local Labour MP.
I was hopping mad when I discovered that Diane Abbott had missed the vote. I felt she had bullied and hectored other MPs into voting to trigger Article 50, and when it came to it, she backed out. And I think there will be a number of people that will not vote for her at the next election.
She did say she had a severe migraine attack.
I think, quite frankly, it's all akin to the dog ate my homework. The general view of people in Stoke Newington, people in Hackney, is that we're staunch Remainers. She should stand by her principles and she should vote against triggering Article 50.
It's not just ordinary Labour supporters here who are kicking against their party's line on Article 50. At the office, where he runs a youth charity, I talked to a Hackney Labour councillor, Mette Coban. Councillor Coban also thinks that Labour MPs should disobey their leader, Jeremy Corbyn. Unless the public are promised a vote on whatever Brexit deal the government comes up with, he says, triggering Article 50 is something Labour must oppose.
The public should be given a second referendum on the terms of Brexit, and if that isn't on the table, then I don't think we should vote to trigger Article 50, because I fear that in the long term, we may face having a situation where we haven't voted for.
Well, that puts your local MP, Diane Abbott, in a rather interesting position, doesn't it? You're saying she should not vote to trigger Article 50, but she is fiercely loyal to the Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who's insisted Labour MPs must vote to trigger Article 50.
Well, I mean, look, with Diane, she's obviously in a tricky situation because Hackney overwhelmingly voted to remain. It's third in the UK. My personal view is I don't think we should give the government a blank cheque. Most people in Hackney are for the European Union.
Diane Abbott is not, of course, the only MP to face this fundamental question of politics. Is an MP in Parliament simply as a delegate of their constituents, or are they supposed to echo faithfully their constituents' views? But this seat of Hackney North and Stoke Newington also embodies a fundamental political dilemma faced by the Labour Party these days. How to keep on side some traditional Labour voters who may not be so keen on mass immigration and who voted for Brexit, how to retain their support, but without losing the votes of the more middle-class liberal wing of the Labour Party, the kind of people who've now moved en masse to this neighbourhood, sometimes jokingly known as the People's Republic of Hackney.
Hackney is a naturally left-wing place. We have quite a lot of Corbynistas, but that has really taken a bit of a hit with the Labour leadership pushing for Article 50.
Keith Magnum is the editor of Hackney Citizen, a local newspaper with a focus on local politics, and he thinks Jeremy Corbyn's insistence that Labour MPs must vote in favour of triggering Article 50 will cause the party serious problems in the long term.
It's not something that the young professionals who make up a lot of the Corbynista vote here are comfortable with. It's not what they want, and I think that may be a real danger. The Lib Dems, you know, much as they are maligned and hated for things like student tuition fees, have managed to make something of a comeback in terms of the metropolitan liberal elite section of the party finding a new home.
Well, I've come now to the crucible of political power here in Hackney, and that's the Hackney Town Hall, home of Hackney Council, which is very much dominated by the Labour Party. And I'm here with a Labour councillor, Guy Nicholson, a passionate campaigner for the Remain cause during the European Union referendum. But, Guy, I gather you feel that now the referendum has happened and there's been a vote for Brexit, you think that Labour MPs like Diane Abbott should come on board and support Article 50?
Triggering Article 50 undoubtedly, as we all recognise, moves the agenda forward to the next step. That next step has to be taken. We cannot sustain this kind of economy in Hackney where we've got this ambiguity, this lack of direction. I want a Labour government in 2020. The behaviour that we've got going on at the moment, a fragmented party, is not going to take us to that destination.
Do you accept, though, that if Diane Abbott now votes to trigger Article 50 in the vote tomorrow, she is going to lose an awful lot of support from people who voted Labour in the last election, people who are such passionate pro-Remainers? They don't want the Labour Party to vote to trigger Article 50.
The job of politicians is to explain why something is happening, to try and reassure, to try and convince, if indeed that's what's needed. If a politician can't do that, they shouldn't be in the job.
There's no sign of Diane Abbott being out of a job anytime soon, but her office has given ambiguous statements about how she'll be voting tomorrow, and she wouldn't be interviewed today if Ms Abbott were to follow her constituents' Europhile leanings and vote against Article 50 tomorrow. That might leave Jeremy Corbyn feeling he had to sack her from the shadow cabinet for breaking a three-line whip. But then she is one of his closest political allies, not to mention the personal history between the two. Hackney politics has often proved rather colourful and combustible. Now that local inclination for high drama seems to have hit the national stage.
Paul Moss reporting. The headlines so far on The World Tonight: MPs and peers will be able to vote on the Brexit deal before it's signed, but they won't be able to send Theresa May back to the negotiations, and Britain will leave the European Union even if no agreement is reached. And the Institute for Fiscal Studies has forecast that spending cuts and tax rises will continue into the next decade. A new law passed by the Israeli parliament, which retrospectively legalises dozens of Jewish settler homes built on private Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank, has faced international criticism. The Foreign Office has said the move paved the way for significant settlement growth in the West Bank and damaged Israel's standing with its international partners. Israel says the law will protect Israeli homes, but both the UN Secretary General and the European Union have warned it'll damage the chances for a peaceful two-state solution. Under the legislation, the Palestinian landowners will be given financial compensation or alternative land. But Palestinians say the presence of settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, land they seek for a future state, makes such a state with contiguous territory impossible. They've demanded Israel freeze all settlement activity as a precondition for resuming any peace talks. And today, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the new law.
This law is against international law and the laws preserving our freedom and our land. We do not accept the latest declaration of the Israeli parliament on the construction of thousands of dwellings on our territory, occupied since 1967. This is an aggression towards our people, and we will challenge it at an international level.
There's criticism in Israel too. The Attorney General has said the law is unconstitutional and that he won't defend it at the Supreme Court. And there was mixed reaction from these people in Tel Aviv.
I think it's a horrible law. I think it's impossible to take lands from their owners and to work against the ownership of people.
There's never been a land called Palestine. The people who live in the settlements, call them settlers, whatever you like, but they believe that it's the biblical land of Israel, and I think they've got as much right to live there as the Palestinians.
The law was pushed through Parliament after police acted last week on a High Court ruling to move about 40 Israeli families living on private Palestinian land in a place called Amona. Well, Ruth Lieberman is a settler and resident of the town of Alon Shvut in the Gush Etzion area, just south of Jerusalem. She explained why this law was so important to her.
There is no clear law, and people, Arabs, Jews, live without really being able to resolve a situation. This law comes to resolve that issue in a very fair way, where people with land claims, in this case, Arabs who come now after many years of a Jew living on a piece of land, contesting who the owner is, will now get 125% compensation as the absentee owners whose land was built on, more or less accidentally, because they hadn't come forth before. This is the kind of thing that will actually be fair and lawful for everyone.
Before this law was passed, both Palestinian and Israeli critics described it as a land grab, and people were concerned that, in a sense, this effective annexation of parts of the West Bank would make it much, much more difficult to move towards a two-state solution.
If we make the legal argument, there is no annexation, there is no land grab. These homes have been there for many, many years. And it's a way to resolve an issue that has actually come up now, and it's almost more than fair. If you talk politics, then absolutely, this is not a question of what we think is legal, but what you or I would want to see at the end of this process, where we both want peace, and we may have different ideas about how to get there.
Is it a provocation, though? The Palestinian president's called it an aggression against our people.
I've heard the Palestinian Authority leadership say many things. I've been told that my own home is the obstacle to peace. When the Israeli government of its own volition stopped any building activity over the Green Line for 10 months, they did it to prove a point, and it didn't bring better negotiations. It didn't bring us closer to peace, because settlements, as they're called, are not the issue. The issue is whether we are here and are we here to stay.
But in this specific land, in the West Bank, the Palestinians would say historically they have lived there for centuries, and this is the land that they would like to make their own future state.
Well, as I look out my window in the Judean Hills, I know that this land was purchased by Jews in the very early 1900s. There wasn't anything here before. Just as when you look at the hill of Amona, there's nothing there. It's empty land. It's even hard to live on. It's cold. It's rocky. It's barren. There are much better options. So, you know, we are an obstinate people and we take what we can get. But this land was purchased legally. And in fact, my home hasn't been brought up in any international circles because it is a solid land purchase and it does belong to the Israeli government and some private individuals. So it's not so clear cut. And I think that the broad generalities are what harm us and get in the way of us really sitting down and talking about the problems.
But there are those who would say it's much simpler than any of this, that this land potentially just belongs to somebody else.
Any person can appeal to the High Court, any Arab, any Jew, and talk about their land rights. The Israeli Supreme Court system listens to that. And I'm proud that Israel, as opposed to, I think, almost any of its neighbors and the Palestinian Authority, has such a strong legal system. We believe in it, and we know that's right.
Settler Ruth Lieberman. Well, it's been reported that even the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was wary of passing the new legislation, arguing that it could be against Israeli and international law, only changing his mind at the last minute. Dennis Ross is a former US ambassador to the Middle East. He's been closely involved in shaping US involvement in the Middle East peace process. I asked him why Israeli politicians would have chosen to pass this law, knowing that it was likely to face a legal challenge.
Well, I think you have key members of the current Israeli government, particularly the party, the Jewish Home, and some elements of the Likud party who feel this is an opportunity because of the Trump administration to clarify what they would like clarified. This is a constituency within Israel that, contrary to the prime minister's position, doesn't believe in two states for two peoples and would like to be in a position where legally there are no limitations on what Israelis can do throughout the West Bank. In effect, this is kind of ex post facto legalization of a fairly significant number of dwellings.
But are they in a sense, reading the mood in the right way. Does the beginning of the Trump presidency mark a new era, a presidency that's seen to be much warmer, much friendlier to Israel than its predecessor?
It's too soon to know. Look, on the one hand, there's no doubt that there was a decision and an impulse on the part of this president and the people around him to show how different they would be from Obama and the Obama administration and the relationship with Israel. But the fact that they came out with a statement last week after the announcements of new Israeli settlements that while they didn't view settlements as being an impediment to peace, they also said that they may not be helpful and that even though they hadn't formulated their own position on settlements yet, they were suggesting that building within existing settlements, not expanding outward in those existing settlements, but building up, not out, that implies that, in fact, their position on settlements could be very similar to what the George W. Bush position was and to what the Bill Clinton position was. And that would signal that those who are making this judgment about the Trump administration on the right in Israel are not correct.
But all of this comes at a time when the Middle East is in turmoil. Is there an opportunity here for real political change in Israel, which may perhaps coincide with the change in America?
I don't know that we can say that political change is in the offing. I do think this action that was taken within Israel was also extremely controversial across the political spectrum. It could also be that the Trump administration, if they adopt the position consistent with their public statement of last week on the settlements, that could lead to an understanding with Netanyahu on limiting settlement activity. If that were to be the case, you're talking about areas that, you know, are probably 5 to 8% of the West Bank, meaning that is consistent with a two-state outcome.
But talk of a two-state solution and settlement blocks and so on, there is no peace process at the moment. Is there likely to be one in any meaningful way in the foreseeable future?
Not unless things change. But the question is, can you get building limited to only within the existing settlement blocks, number one, and can you get the Palestinians? If there's that kind of an action by the Israelis, can you get the Palestinians to drop their anti-normalization campaign against Israel, to stop providing funding for the Martyrs Foundation? If there is a Palestinian who is killed trying to kill an Israeli, you know, their family gets funded by the PLO. Well, that's hardly an indication that you're accepting a kind of coexistence with the Israelis. So if you could get both sides to adopt positions that would be consistent with stated public policy of being committed to two states, then you could get back into the business of peacemaking. Right now, we're a long ways from that.
Former US Ambassador to the Middle East, Dennis Ross. Are you winding down after a long day at work? How would you feel about working for just 6 hours a day on full pay? A growing number of employers in Sweden have been testing that idea over the past couple of years. But the most high-profile public sector trial has just ended, while a number of private companies have admitted it was bad for business. So is the concept too good to be true? Maddie Savage reports from Gothenburg.
There's a chatty bunch of day patients here at what's become Sweden's most famous care home, Svartedalen. It started testing six-hour days 2 years ago, but the project wrapped up in December.
Hey, I am Emily and I work here, and now I sit and play board game with one of the people that live here.
She got a six. How was your working day when you were working 6 hours?
We had more energy, and when we come home, we could have a social life in the home too. And when we come for the work, it was like more easy, and you see on everybody, like, it was good. Now it's a little bit more harder.
Independent researchers recorded a significant drop in sick days and a hike in productivity, with nurses organising 85% more activities for patients during the first 18 months. A final report is due out in March.
I think it's been successful. It's put the shortening of the workday on the agenda, both for Sweden and for Europe.
That's Daniel Bernmar, the Left Party councillor responsible for running elderly care in Gothenburg. He's pushing for further pilots efforts, but faces opposition from local rivals concerned about the cost. The Svartedalen experiment saved money on sick pay, yet still added up to more than £1 million.
Would we do this for the entire municipality? The answer is no. It will be too expensive. What we've learned is that we can afford to do that on specific workplaces where we know we have poor working conditions, but doing a general shortening of the work week, we need to have the national government involved.
And right now, they're not playing ball with that at all?
Right now, not at all.
Despite no national political consensus for six-hour days, several other councils have also taken matters into their own hands, locally funding trials for social workers, hospital nurses and even cleaners. A handful of small businesses have been testing the idea too. Some have reported a boost in staff morale or less sick leave, but I'm on my way to visit 3D printing firm Selink, where CEO Eric Gattenholm's experiment got scrapped when staff became more stressed.
We were reading about the sector and we said, imagine if it works well.
What happened though?
Well, so we gave it a try in the production of our bioprinters, and we realized, you know, things don't always work as you plan. You have things that come up. So then the last day of the week essentially became this very long day where we had to just do everything that we didn't have time to do. I really don't think that the six-hour workday fits with the entrepreneurial world or the startup world.
In a country that's already obsessed with work-life balance, it's no surprise that growing numbers of academics are also studying the trials. Dr. Aram Sedig is a researcher based in Stockholm.
6 hours working day would be most effective in organizations such as in hospitals for nurses where you work 6 hours and then you just leave the work and go home. And it might be less effective for organizations where the boundaries between work and private life is not so clear. I think it's a mindset from the leaders that is very important.
Back in Gothenburg, it's clear that whether or not the six-hour trend spreads, Sweden is already streets ahead of most places in terms of limiting overtime. It's only 4:30 p.m. and the blue trams are packed with people heading home. But just like the politicians, they're deeply divided over whether workers really need more time off.
I'm not sure that it works so well because there's so much competition nowadays. In other countries, I think there's a lot of people that are willing to work a lot.
I think it will work. It's kind of a good step towards the future. You have to think about like people before work.
I think you will actually save money because people are sick all the time and don't go to work.
Well, I, contrary to my daughter, I think we can work 8 hours. We've done it before successfully, so why don't continue?
Just the eight, eh? That report from Maddie Savage in Sweden. Just time for tonight's main headlines. The government's announced that MPs and Lords will be able to vote on the Brexit deal before it's finalised. But ministers say that if they reject it, Theresa May won't return to the negotiations and Britain will leave the European Union without an agreement. The Institute for Fiscal Studies has forecast that spending cuts and tax rises will continue into the next decade. And the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, has said that a new Israeli law legalising existing Jewish settlements is an attack against his people. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at BBC World Tonight. And you can email us world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. That is The World Tonight. I'm Ritula Shah. For now, from me and everyone on the programme, good night. You can also find more BBC podcasts at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.